Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, along with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hello, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Summer is most definitely upon us, and according to winemaker Matt Nissen of Prairie Moon Winery, if this weather keeps up, it could be a good year for grapes.
And for us, we really need a hot weather and we need dry weather for these grapes to really reach their full potential.
I speak with Matt later in the show about the evolution of his family's business and especially about the summer series of concerts they have out there, which we attended together last weekend, Ursula.
It was really a lovely Sunday afternoon at the winery with music, a nice breeze, and a wood-fired pizza.
We also bring back an archived interview you had with Lisa Hine of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation back in 2012 about the High Trestle Trail Bridge stretching across the Des Moines River Valley, another of Central Iowa's most popular summertime attractions.
I did that interview back in the very beginning of KHOI broadcast days when we were first learning how to do local talk. It was one of my favorite interviews of that first year, and it really began to open up my eyes to the uniqueness of this place beyond what I knew of Ames as my hometown growing up.
Well, and speaking of the Des Moines River, you have a story to tell from this weekend's flotilla to oppose the Bakken pipeline. Let's begin the show there. What happened on Saturday and why?
Well, last Saturday afternoon, approximately 100 people floated down the Des Moines River in canoes and kayaks to raise awareness about the Bakken pipeline. And the flotilla floated past the place where the pipeline is planned to go under the Des Moines River. And the event was organized by the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition, which is a growing grassroots coalition of landowners, community members, nonprofit organizations, and various interest groups united to stop the construction of the proposed Bakken pipeline. There were about 30 groups involved that day. And like I said, about 100 people participated. And afterwards, there was a community event in Pilot Mound, including a very animated speech from the mayor of Pilot Mound, and a potluck dinner, and lots of discussion and speeches about the pipeline. And I was in the flotilla and to see what was going on, and I had the fortune of sharing a canoe with Dick Lamb, who is one of the landowners who is part of the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. And Dick and his wife, Judy, own land in Boone County. They live in Iowa City, but they have a farm in Boone County that's been in their family since the 1970s. And they were some of the landowners that are contesting the use of their land for the construction of the Bakken Pipeline by the Dakota Access Corporation. And the Lambs are calling for Iowans to stand with them in contesting what they see as government overreach in taking their farmland. They say they feel betrayed by the state government. And I think Dick has joined us on the phone. I asked him to stop by this morning to explain to us why he feels that way and just to tell us a little bit about what is happening with the Bakken Pipeline from the perspective of a landowner. Dick, are you with us?
Indeed, I am. And my wife, Judy, is also on the phone.
Excellent.
Here.
Good. Hello, Judy. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for this opportunity.
Yeah.
And one little correction there, if I might.
Oh, please.
This farm had been in our family since the 1970s, and actually it was the 1870s.
Oh, I apologize.
My grandfather, we have long generations in our family.
So you,
so it's my grandfather, and so it has a you know, quite a meaning to not just my wife and myself, but to the whole family, including some cousins that we bought out a few years ago that they're still interested in how this is going.
Did you grow up on this land?
I did not. We skipped a generation in working it, and I grew up in town. My dad was a school teacher there, and Judy actually is from Boone, too. Her dad had a little tax service there in Boone.
So when you say you grew up in town, you say you're a native of Boone, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Boone, Iowa. So we would regularly, of course, visit the farm when I was young, and so it means a lot to us.
And what is happening on the farm right now? Is it being used as farmland?
Oh yes, absolutely. In fact, the family that operates the farm, they operate other farms and have land of their own, but they are also in their third generation with us. So this is kind of unusual to have the farm operators and the owners working together for a long period of time like that.
And the land is in Boone County, right?
That's right, just mm-hmm. outside of Ames, just a little bit to the west of Ames, about 3 miles on U.S. 30 at the point where the pipeline would cross U.S. 30. And right now there's a big semi-trailer on there with giant letters that says, stop eminent domain abuse. So if you drive between Boone and Ames,
that's your land.
Can't miss mm-hmm. that.
And how many acres is the land?
It's about 300 acres, mm-hmm. 150 in each side of the highway.
Okay, so you're opposed to the building of the Paucon Pipeline. Can you give us kind of an overview of why you take that position?
Well, that's a really good question because there's just too many reasons that I could even go into here. But just from the beginning, here we are fracking oil in North Dakota, terribly environmentally destructive for many reasons. Very quickly, it's a race to drain America here to extract this oil to export it. Does nothing for domestic oil independence, which has been billed for. We're opposed to the use of these fossil fuels when we should be moving toward alternatives. Now, you know, we can't immediately stop using oil, of course, but we should be moving to more toward solar and wind. And, of course, Iowa's been a leader in wind. And we're against the pipeline for transporting it, and particularly for going through Iowa, where we have here in Iowa among the best land in all the world. The most productive, richest, deep black soil combined with a favorable growing season and with adequate rainfall, and to be tearing that up for a pipeline is just unconscionable. So that's some of the reasons.
Mm-hmm. Now, you actually have a very personal relationship to this. You're not just doing this on theory. You actually are one of the people who own the land where the pipeline will be or is slated to be. Tell us a little bit, what, from the perspective of a landowner, how does this actually happen? What happened? How did you find out that the pipeline would be on your land?
It started, about a year and a half ago or something like that?
I think that was about it.
Yeah, and when we first got a letter and just came in the mail, and at first... we just kind of thought, another utility passing through, not a big deal. And then we got to looking, and it's 30 inches. That's just a gigantic thing. And, of course, you can't put that in the ground without serious damage. And then we started joining various protest groups and taking part in all the activities.
The 30 inches refers to how wide the pipe is. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. It's a 30-inch diameter pipe. So just the easement to put it in is a permanent easement is 50 feet wide, and then a construction easement of 150 feet wide. So, it's a big pipeline. I don't think Iowa has anything of this magnitude.
And when you get a letter like this, how is that actually? How does that actually happen? I mean, do they basically ask you or tell you, or I mean, how is one told that one's land is going to be used for a pipeline?
This letter said that they would be seeking voluntary easements, I think the first letter implied they would have eminent domain, but it was a series of letters and offers and so forth, but. they are still trying to get people to sign voluntarily. Now, when we say voluntarily, that sort of put that in quotes because, you know, you've got a gun to your head. They have this threat of eminent domain, and what they're saying is you can avoid that if you voluntarily sign this easement. And so there have been a lot of steps and offers and negotiation with landowners and so forth, but now they're at the point where they're actually filing eminent domain papers on people. And we got ours about 2 weeks ago, I think, wasn't it, Judy?
Yes, about 2 weeks ago. And our hearing will be July 12th.
And what is involved with a hearing like that? I mean, what is being disputed?
Well, there's not a whole lot to dispute at that point. They're just setting what money they're going to give you for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process that's pretty well a done deal as far as the construction once they have that, unless it wins in court. Now, if we can get back to that, that's another matter. But just to give you some perspective on this eminent domain issue, the notice that Judy mentioned there was it was like we were criminals, I think I could say, because a process server came to our door. You know, you see that in the detective movies and so forth, and never quite thought of that would be happening to us. And it mentions condemnation, and in the response that our lawyer prepared for us.
So when you say it mentions condemnation, they're saying your land is condemned?
Yes, exactly. Condemned, as if it's guilty of something. And not only the land, but we are too. And our lawyer refers to us in the notice responding, we're referred to as condemnees, sort of like prisoners about to be executed. And even this whole process is amazing because we were given this date. You know, no choice. Nobody called up and said, well, we've got three or four openings here, and would one of them work out for you? We'll see what we can, you know, nothing like that. It was, this is it. This is the date. You better not have a surgery planned. You better not have your European vacation. This is your date, like the court said it, and nothing you can do about it. So, again, you know, we kind of feel like the whole process is we're treated by criminals, and our crime was just not cooperating with this outfit that wants to take our land.
Dick, this is Greta Anderson. I'm co-hosting today with Ursula. I wondered whether you have interacted in person with any of the pipeline representatives and what those interactions were like.
we have just a couple cases. Early on, we just said, and we've always tried to be very polite to them. We realize the people that are making the phone calls are not the decision makers. You know, they're hired to do this, and most of them are contract employees. Move on to some other project after the pipeline, but they've not been unpleasant. But they follow the company guidelines, which basically I think are a deception.
What do you mean by that?
For instance, early on they said, you want to take this deal, you'll just never get a better one. You don't want to go through this condemnation process, and they're right, that's terribly stressful. But they said, you want to take this deal, and now we're at the point where they're offering a couple, three times as much money as they did initially. So those poor people at first who signed up and took the deals right away, they really didn't get anywhere near the kind of monetary reward that they would have if they just waited. And so, you know, I felt they were deceptive in that practice. That's not to say the people calling knew that, but the executives that were making these decisions basically, I think, deceived them. One landowner told me, at this point, they're just picking off the elderly widows. And I think that was the size of it. You know, the people who didn't get good financial advice kind of deceived and rushed into it.
About how many landowners are involved in the struggle? How many people have dragged their feet and stood up to the company?
Boy, at this point, what do you think, Judy?
I'm just not sure, because every day someone gives up the fight just because it is very stressful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, you know, maybe Judy can speak to that better than I can, but it is a very stressful situation. And I think at the point before they started getting aggressive, we were about 85-90% had signed voluntarily. But then, well, it stands these last couple weeks, I'm just not sure.
Mm-hmm. Dick and Judy Lamb, you own land in Boone County, and the pipeline is going to go through your land, or is proposed to go through your land. Why exactly don't you want it specifically on your land? You've given us reasons why you feel, in the bigger picture, why a pipeline isn't a good idea in Iowa. But what exactly is the impact that it'll have on your property itself?
Well, you know, one big one, of course, is these things always leak. They have just a terrible record. There was just last week, in fact, you know, you hardly even hear them on the news anymore. There's so many of them. In Ventura, California, there was a big spill. There have been million-gallon spills, and if that happens, it could devastate our farmland, of course. And I just don't think we could be counting on the company to do anything about it. They'll probably be out of business by the time that anything happens. They didn't even exist until they were going to build this pipeline, and they'll probably sell it to somebody else as soon as it's done, is my guess. But you got the leak thing. You've got the damage to the ground as you're trenching it, running this heavy equipment over it, the disturbance of the soils. Getting it level so that you can farm it is a diagonal route, the worst possible route to go across the farm, cutting from the one corner to the opposite corner. And there's certain liability issues with it. If we were, and it's kind of complicated legally, but if you sign a voluntary easement, you could be personally responsible for some of these spills, as I understand it. And in any event, when they abandon this thing, and those wells will play out in North Dakota at some point, maybe within a decade or so, you've got the equivalent of thousands of abandoned fuel tanks strung across the state. And to have that on our land and be responsible for that, and maybe the cleanup of it, the cleanup of that could be far more than they're offering people to put it in the first place. So, that's some of the reasons we don't want it.
Oh, okay. So, in other words, you're saying it really will alter your land forever, is kind of what I hear you saying.
Uh-huh. It also will limit what use we could make of the land. I mean, we have no plans other than farming right now, but you can't build over a pipeline.
You can't put roads except certain angles and only certain kinds of roads. Our land, you know, carry this a little bit further, is just outside of Ames, within mm-hmm. about 2.5 miles of city limits. There are commercial office buildings right next door. And that would mean the pipeline would mean that Ames couldn't progress in that direction. The pipeline determines the future plans of Ames, and certainly our ability to use that land for anything else. And again, we really don't want to. It's excellent farmland, but we feel that should be our decision. You know, we shouldn't have this private corporation come in and grab our land for their profit and simply take that away from us.
We're speaking with Dick and Judy Lamb. They own property in Boone County, just outside of Ames, just west of Ames. And they are one of the properties where the Bakken Pipeline is slated to be built. Now, you're both in the lawsuit against the pipeline?
Absolutely, we
mm-hmm.
are.
Mm-hmm. And just real briefly, can you give us an update on the status of that lawsuit and your... You know, do you think that it has a potential to actually have an effect on what's happening?
Yeah. You know, it's hard to know. It's very complicated. And the issue here is the way I see it is, what is a utility? This pipeline company is a private corporation licensed under the lax laws of Delaware. It's a subsidiary of a Texas corporation, and Iowa law allows eminent domain for utilities. But the question here is this really a utility? Because it doesn't provide any services to Iowans. The Iowa Utilities Board has no authority to regulate it after it's built. Can't do safety inspections on it, can't set rates that they can charge. It has absolutely no control at all. And the only thing it can do is determine the routing of it to some extent when it's being built and give the decision to use eminent domain. So we're saying this really isn't a utility because it doesn't serve Iowans. We have no oil wells. We have no refineries. It just passes through the state. And so if the courts agree with that, the trouble is it's probably going to be built by the time we get the ruling. But if the courts agree with it, you know, then it would stop further use. It may force them to tear it out of the ground. Not sure what all the implications are, but we're fighting for that.
And also, we don't have any hearing date for it yet, so we don't know when they're going to hear this.
Mm-hmm. So, bottom line, are you hopeful, or how do you feel about all this as people who are directly involved?
How do we feel, Judy?
Mm-hmm.
Some days we're optimistic, but a lot of days we just think it's a done deal and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of seemed that way from the very start.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it did. It's an emotional thing, and to put it in perspective, families go through worse things. It can't be equated with a life-threatening illness and the like. But still, you know, it's very stressful going through that.
And are you glad that you have spoken up and not cooperated originally, or do you feel that in a way it has been a waste of your time to do that?
No, speaking for myself, no, I don't regret a thing there. This is the wrong thing for Iowa. It's the wrong thing for the country, and we need to speak up to stop this sort of both government overreach and destructive environmental practices. And I'm glad we've done as much as we have, whether in this case it's effective or not. Maybe it'll stop the next one. What do you think, Judy?
I'm just very glad we've spoken up, and we, our children have really encouraged us to. So that's how I feel. I just would like to stop it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us.
Thanks so much. We want to get the story out, and this helps a great deal, so it's been our pleasure.
It was late in the summer when the corn was fully grown. We'd gone for a swim in the pond on my Uncle Henry's farm. And when we got home, we saw a badger in the yard, running flat out for a hole beneath the shed. It disappeared into its den underneath the floor, and it was gone, and Dad just said, goddamn. Badger can't stay, he'll kill you just like that. Mean as any grizzly, sneaky as any cat. And he went and got his gun in the closet in the hall, and he pulled a six-pack from the fridge, and he walked out the door. Well, Mom made us brush our teeth and get ourselves to bed. It's late and he'll be a while, was all that she would say. And I saw him in the twilight with his 410 across his lap, sitting in a lawn chair, staring at the shed. Fallen soldier from the six-pack laying at his feet, and sometime in the night a gunshot woke me from my sleep. It was late in the summer when the corn was fully grown. We'd gone for a swim in the pond on my Uncle Henry's farm.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're your hosts, Greta Anderson and Ursula Rudenberg. And that was Charlie Parr from his album Barn Swallow. Barn swallows are a kind of bird that return to a favorite spot every summer, generation after generation. And my husband and I are lucky to have some that come to our farm because they zoom around consuming mosquitoes. Charlie Parr from Minnesota is a little like those barn swallows, as he seems to come to Ames every summer to do a show or two.
That's right. We saw him last Sunday as part of the Live from the Crib series at the Prairie Moon Winery. We called it that because the stage is half of a corn crib with a roof to shade the musicians and the decorative vines around it. So it's a great name for that series. It's visually very accurate.
And I couldn't help noticing the lineup this year included some interesting acts. So I caught up with Matt Nissen, the lead winemaker at Prairie Moon, who is deeply involved in this project ever since his father started it almost 10 years ago. Here's my interview with Matt. So I'm here with Matt Nissen, the winemaker at Prairie Moon Winery, and something of a general manager.
Yep. I've done a little bit of everything, being a family business. I mean, from day one, I've delivered wine. I've done wine tastings. I've done events. I've made wine. I've crushed grapes. I've picked grapes. So, I mean, I've done a little bit of everything. But now, mainly, my main focus is doing some tours and public tours for people and doing mainly the wine kegging and some of the wine bottling.
And summer is a big time for you here at Prairie Moon Winery. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's one of those where once April gets here, we start to get into a really busy season. Up until Christmas, we stay pretty busy. January through March is pretty quiet. We have some smaller events and stuff out here. But once May gets here, it really comes into full swing with our music on Friday nights during May usually. And we started doing some in April on Friday nights too. And then once June gets here, we have our Sunday live music events, which are in full swing right now. So.
That's right. You have had four concerts, Sunday concerts so far. They go from 3 to 6 in the afternoon, and I count 12 more that you have scheduled for the future. Pretty much every Sunday, except you're taking 4th of July off.
Yep. Being a family-run business, and being that we're here a lot of weekends, and my mom and dad own it, so they're always around here, and they're always involved with it. We're here doing wine. My wife's here doing the events. My sister's here too. We got to have one weekend that we can all take and get a breather, kind of. We call it our midsummer kind of a breather where we take a little bit of vacation. Our tasting room will still be open until July 2nd on Saturday. We'll still have tastings open on that Friday and Saturday of the July 4th weekend, but we'll be closed on Sunday the 3rd and Monday the 4th for kind of a little bit of a break for us to kind of get away and relax and regather ourselves before busy rest of July and August.
Well, I was at the Sunday event, this past Sunday's event. It was very nice. It seems your schedule, your lineup here seems to include a few regional acts that are kind of exciting, including this past show that I went to, Charlie Parr.
Yeah, Charlie was great to have this weekend. We used to just kind of book it all of ourselves, but with the help of Nate Lodgson, who runs Maximum Ames Music Fest, we're doing a few different things, and with his help booking, we booked a couple bit larger acts, which we have one that we can't announce right now. We'll be able to announce later on this summer, about a month before the show, who it's going to be, but we got a really, really big act coming out here, and we're really excited for that. So, but yeah, having a lot of local Ames people, people that have grown up around this scene and seen our place grow, they're playing out here. And then some of our old favorites, some people that have been playing here for years and years and years, and even people like BJ Fleming, who's going to be here on the 31st of July. BJ was here from the year one that we opened, and we became really good friends with BJ, and she moved away, and now she's able to come back during the summer. So it'll be great to see her come back from Ohio to play a show here in Ames.
What year was that when you first started these Sunday concerts?
We started the concerts, I believe, in 2007. We're going to be celebrating in August, which we're working on some ideas right now. The end of August will be our 10-year anniversary since we opened. So it's hard to believe, but we opened August 21st, I think, the third weekend in August in 2006. So it's already been 10 years, and it's come a long way from what we had then. We didn't even have a banquet hall. We didn't have a lot of the stuff that we've grown into now. I think we've come around to have a full service facility that we can host all kinds of community events and be a great asset to everyone around here.
That's true. I think I went to one of those concerts the first year, and it just, what I remember was so different from the setting that is currently here. With it was sort of like a big field. Everyone was baking under the sun. And now you've planted a bunch of trees. They've matured quite a bit. There's some shade. There's a pizza, a brick pizza oven. Tell me about the oven.
Well, I was in culinary science and hospitality management at Iowa State. That's what I graduated in. So I've always been a big foodie, kind of cooking and all that. And then we actually lucked into someone that won an actual pizza oven dome. The dome that goes inside of our structure was won by someone on the Price is Right game show, and they were never going to use it. So they gave it to us for a big discount, and then we built a beautiful structure around it. And we thought, you know, when we had the concerts, we were always like, we need some food options, or we wish we would have had some food options to go with it. So it was a natural evolution to kind of get something like that out here. So now we actually have a fully licensed kitchen here at Prairie Moon that we can serve ready-to-made food out of. And the pizzas have just been a great thing. I love wood-fired pizza. So I did a lot of research on it, and we perfected the dough now, which is the main thing in Italian wood-fired pizza, is perfecting that dough to get a nice fluffy crust with that, you know, burnt underside a little bit, and all those kind of charred flavors to go along with really, really high-quality toppings, which we make all of our sauce ourselves. We source a lot of our ingredients from Lacewing Acres Farm next door or anyone else local that we can get it from. So
it tasted good, I will say that. Yeah, the guy you have delivering the pizzas to the customers, they take a number when they pay for it and order it. He was just going back and forth and back and forth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's Petey. He's our head brewer over at Alluvial Brewing. So on Sundays, we rope him into being our delivery guy, and he's a character. He loves to wear big, flashy outfits that don't really match, and a tie with that. And he's got, if anyone's met him before, you know him for his handlebar mustache for sure. So he loves to show that thing off. So it's been fun. I mean, most Sundays when we're out here, we serve over 120 pizzas. So it's fast and furious, and it's something that people have really come out here for. It's really drawn people out along with the music and the wine, and now we have the Alluvial beer next door that we can serve some of that over here too for the non-wine drinkers. So
Yep, it's full service, and there are plenty of kids playing around, and there was just a sense that this was even closer than a community. It was almost a family.
Yeah, we've always kind of, kids are always, families are always welcome. There's just not as many activities I think you can do as a full family. I mean, if you're going to a place like that, it's usually just adults only, but we don't really have that kind of a feel here. It's more of just kind of like a gathering of the community people around here and enjoying a nice Sunday afternoon. And I mean, it's the middle of the day on a Sunday, and usually that time of the day people are looking for something to do, and then the music ends at 6 and they can go home to have dinner or finish their night out or whatever. But it's just a nice middle of the afternoon kind of getaway for people on a Sunday. So
did you ever imagine your life would be like this when you were figuring out what you were going to do with it?
No, never really imagined that, and I don't think a lot of us would. But when my dad got into grape growing and then into winemaking, and then when I graduated Iowa State, and then it was kind of that thing where he just had started thinking of ideas, and that's kind of been our family, our mantra as our family, where we have all these ideas all the time. We're known as idea persons, so we're glad we have a lot of people around us to help execute the plan, and that's what you need is a good team of people that you trust and people that are basically your family because they work with you every day. So we have a great team here at Prairie Moon that we can get things accomplished and provide a great atmosphere for people and great customer service. So,
well, you've done a great job. Can I just ask, do you trample the grapes with your feet?
We have done, and I think we're going to do that again this year. We're still lining up, but to have like a grape stomping thing out here where we have a competition to see how fast you can fill up a wine bottle with your stomping. We have a little platform, and it was fun. We haven't done it for a few years just because we've gotten so busy, but I think we might revive it this year. But no, to press as many grapes as we need would take a long, long time. So we use a traditional grape press for all the winemaking, but we'll leave the grape stomping for the fun.
And what's the best year of Prairie Moon wine?
Personally, I think it was about 4 years ago. We had some really good years. Unfortunately, the last 2 years have been like the two worst years I've seen for grape ripening in Iowa. Just way too much rain during the ripening period, which is the end of July until all the way through August. And last August, it would just rain about every 2 to 3 days. And for us, we really need a hot weather, and we need dry weather for these grapes to really reach their full potential. And last 2 years have just been a miserable combination of fungus problems, and then when the rains so much, the grapes almost suck up so much water they explode. I mean, they just can't handle that much moisture when they're fully ripe. So we're praying for a good year this year of stable, drier. I mean, if it rains a little bit, fine, just not like it has been in the past. So a nice 80 degrees ripening in August, and we should have a nice crop this year. They look really nice right now in the vineyard. They had a nice fruit set on there, so there's fruit hanging out there now. We just need to get them to ripeness for make good wine this year. So
I imagine you have to water it during these very hot days, dry days that we've had.
No, right now actually is about the cutoff. If it had been a little bit drier early in the year, we probably would have irrigated a little bit. But from now on, we won't water a bit. So the roots on grapes go down about 15 feet, so they can get plenty of water when they need it. And when they're stressed a little bit, it actually makes the fruit taste better. So it's weird. That's why most people don't realize that. That's why some of the best winemaking places in the world, like your Napas and your Bordeaux and stuff like that, it's really rocky, dry soil there. Well, that stresses the plant, and it makes the grapes on those plants more flavorful. So a stressed plant makes good grapes.
Yeah, that's right. It produces more antioxidants, yeah, too. It's better for you. Okay, well, you lead a fascinating life, Matt Nissen. Seems like a lot of fun.
It is. It can be fun and stressful at all at the same time, but when you get to see a lot of people enjoy your place, and people enjoy your wine and your facility, and our great staff here. It all adds up to be could be a lot worse things.
That was Matt Nissen of the Prairie Moon Winery, and this is Local Talk. We're your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Greta Anderson. And so, Greta, it seems like this hot and dry weather keeps up. The grapevines in Iowa will get stressed out, and the wine will be halfway decent this year?
Yeah, I guess what's good for the corn seems to be bad for the wine, and vice versa. It's hard to know who to root for.
As if we had any say in the matter.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme of this show. We're focusing on the positives in Central Iowa in the second half of the show. And so we thought we'd bring back that interview you did way back at the beginning of our broadcast days in 2012, the one with Lisa Hine.
Yeah, this was one of the early interviews that we did when we just started airing KHOI or being on the air. And as someone returning to Ames and Central Iowa after being gone for a long time, I was just beginning to discover the very special gems we have here and how things had changed in Iowa. And one of the things that changed was that the High Trestle Bridge had been built. The High Trestle Trail, as I think a lot of people in the area know, is a very, very special part in our area. And I spoke with Lisa Hine of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation to find out more about the bridge and the bike trail and the design of its artwork. And for anybody who's been out there late at night, I went out with my 95-year-old father to walk to the bridge one night and to look at it in the middle of the night. And the spiral frames or gates that have become an iconic image in Central Iowa is a very beautiful sight to see. So here's the interview with Lisa. This is Ursula Rudenberg for Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And I'm here with Lisa Hine from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the Natural Heritage Foundation does?
Sure. Thanks. The Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation has been around since 1979, and we are a nonprofit land conservation organization. So we actually work throughout the entire state of Iowa in helping to protect lands that become wildlife areas, habitat, county parks, state parks. We help communities work on projects that help protect natural areas and groundwater and things like that. And because of our experience in land protection and land acquisition, early on we got involved in helping acquire discontinued railroad corridors. Some of the very first trail projects that we were involved in include Cedar Valley Nature Trail that runs from Cedar Falls and Waterloo to Cedar Rapids, the Heritage Trail, which runs outside of Dubuque, the Raccoon River Valley Trail, the Wabash Trace Nature Trail, 63 miles in southwest Iowa. And the trails are a great way for people to get outside and enjoy nature, and then hopefully that will lead to a greater awareness of the overall need to protect our environment and protect the Iowa landscape.
One of the most spectacular is the High Trestle Bridge. For anybody who has seen it, especially at night, it's an unforgettable sight. Mm-hmm. Can you describe a little bit what is on the High Trestle Bridge?
The High Trestle Bridge is part of the High Trestle Trail, and the High Trestle Trail runs from Ankeny through Slater, Madrid, over to Woodward. So it's 25 miles. The bridge itself spans the Des Moines River Valley between Madrid and Woodward. So it sits 13 stories in the air, and it's a half mile long. It was part of the Union Pacific Railroad corridor that was discontinued in about 2003. When the railroad discontinued use, they took down the decking to use at their new bridge that was going in over the Des Moines River near Boone, part of their main line that runs through Ames. And so we were left with, I think it's 44 pillars across the river valley. So there were pillars that were left, but no connections. So part of the project was actually having to rebuild the bridge surface and the bridge deck.
So how did it become a bike trail and a hiking trail?
Yeah. When Union Pacific Railroad planned for the discontinuance of that line, we stepped in to negotiate the purchase of that line for public use, and they provided a significant bargain sale to us, so they contributed a lot of land value. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation formed a steering committee made up of representatives from Ankeny, Sheldahl, Slater, Madrid, and Woodward, and Story County, Boone County, Dallas County, and Polk County. So the steering committee worked together, and we helped guide them to find grant dollars to help build the trail. The first two sections built in about 2006 were a mile in Ankeny and a half mile or less in Woodward. And in 2006, Congress authorized a special appropriation for this project of a little over $5 million. That was the spark that really gave us the leverage to build a large section of it. And I think what really put the icing on the cake was the art. I got the idea of putting art on trail bridges from the folks down in Fairfield, Iowa. They're involving artists on their trail bridges, and they got the idea from Tucson, Arizona. So I suggested to the committee, what do you think of this idea? Let's see about putting some art on the bridge. And they're like, sure, that sounds great. David Dahlquist, the public artist that you see a lot of his work across Iowa, he was selected by the committee, and he did the concepts for what we call cribs, the square shapes that are lit up. There's a lot of coal mining history in this part of the river valley, so that square shape is based on what you would see entering a coal mine, and then he rotated it so that it would give some interest. There's pillars on each end, about 40-foot tall pillars on each end.
With coal on them.
Yeah, seams of coal that have been actually clay tile that Dahlquist created. And the cribs go across the entire bridge, but over the river valley, they're about 15 feet apart, and that's the part that's lit up. So, and that's, it rotates all across the bridge, but that part is very dense, and that's where the main.
And so when you stand there at night, the cribs are lit up with thin blue lines, neon lines. And when you stand at one end, the rotating images look like you're looking down a mine shaft. It creates an optical illusion. I never would have thought it would work with such a simple, such a simple construct of just some squares. But it really does.
It's a pretty amazing story.
Well, and it also has to be said, the view is very spectacular.
It is. And there's some neat geology from the Des Moines River Valley. The melting of the glaciers 10,000 years ago really helped carve the Des Moines River Valley. And there's also the coal mining history in there as well. And there's some interesting railroad history. Before they built the bridges, they had to go down into the river valley and kind of curve and come up. And a lot of times they would derail and they'd get down to the bottom and have to sort of haul one car at a time up the valley on the other side. So it was very cumbersome and slow going. And about 1912, the Milwaukee line, which owned the railroad at the time, came in and built all new bridges across that area. So there are some interpretive panels that are out on the bridge itself that tell a little bit about the natural history and as well as the cultural history, the railroad history of that corridor in the river valley. So folks will find that interesting as well.
And there's historical photographs of the bridge
itself. And there's a neat overlook, actually. That's the other interesting part about the bridge is on the west end of the bridge, there's an scenic overlook that was part of the first railroad bridge. And so there's an area for people to gather, and there's picnic tables and things like that up there.
And I think by the overlook, there's a station where you can phone in for historical information.
You know, the Des Moines River Valley itself is spectacular, and this bridge would be a showstopper just because of Mother Nature and being 13 stories high over the Des Moines River. And the art just takes it over the top, and it makes it a world-class icon now.
It's a magical site, and one of the things that makes it magical is that you can't really drive up to it.
The easiest way to get there is to get on Highway 210, which runs between Madrid and Woodward and also goes through Slater. And just west of Madrid, there's a road called QF Lane, and there's a sign that says High Trestle Trail Parking. And so you turn south off of 210, and there's a parking area, and it's about a half-mile walk in to the bridge. Or you can take your bicycle, and it's wheelchair accessible. And there's even somebody in Madrid that has a supply of wheelchairs. So, like, for example, my mom, she's not in a wheelchair, but she's old enough that half a mile is a pretty hard walk for her. I can borrow a wheelchair and take her out there. That's the easiest way. Or you can bicycle. Heck, you can bicycle from Ames. You can get on a bicycle and take the bike lanes down the County Line Road, R38. That takes you to Slater. Get on the trail in Slater and bike all the way over to the bridge. Round trip, it's about 50 miles. It's a nice little Saturday afternoon bike ride for a lot of folks.
How many people use the trail?
The bridge itself receives about 500 people a day,
wow.
And there's probably about 300 on the rest of the trail, 200 to 300 people a day.
So what kind of things do people say about the bridge? and that trail.
It's magical. I think that's probably the one thing I hear. You mentioned it earlier, that it's just magical. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to describe. One time I was out there, and there was a gentleman from Coon Rapids, and he was in his upper 80s, and it was a very windy day. And the wind comes down that river valley a lot anyway. But he was walking, holding onto the railing, hand over fist, you know, walking into these 30-mile-an-hour gusts. And my husband and I came along and we were like, do you need some help? And he's like, no, this is the best time of my life. I'm having so much fun. I'm picking my ride up on the other side of the bridge, and I'm determined to get across there. And he was just having a blast.
So did the biking culture in Iowa take a step forward with this bridge?
I think biking and walking and just being outdoors, that whole aspect took a big leap forward, because we build so many places for our cars, we don't always build places for people. And in this case, being way up high at the top of the river valley where you can be out there without any vehicles, it's just a wonderful way to experience nature and watch the birds fly above you and below you. And mm-hmm. it's Iowa Outdoors, I think, took a big leap forward with this project. And I think the other exciting thing about this project is economic development that's occurred in some of the communities. There's folks from all over Iowa and the Midwest and the country that come to see this trail and experience trails in Iowa as a whole, because we like to promote Iowa as the world capital of trails. We've got thousands of miles of trails in the state, and it's just amazing. You know, it's been said years ago, Iowa doesn't have mountains like Colorado and doesn't have oceans like the coasts, but we have an amazing trail system, and we've really worked hard over the last 20, 30 years to develop the trail system. High Trestle Trail is just, you know, it wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the other trails that have come before it. And but this one has seen new restaurants in Woodward, and I think about three new restaurants in Madrid, a new restaurant in Slater. Ankeny is trying to develop a whole new trail access point with a farmer's market area built around the main trail access point. So there's a lot going on, and I really look forward to the businesses in the communities realizing how much this trail brings in, and looking forward to them being creative in getting trail users off the trail and into their towns. And it is exciting.
Where is a good place to get information about the bridge online?
Sure. You folks can go to our website, which is inhf.org. inhf.org, which is Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.org. Folks can call our office. That number is 515-288-1846.
Repeat it.
515-288-1846.
Where can one get a bicycle map of the state for trails?
The Iowa Department of Transportation publishes a bicycling map for Iowans, and it outlines the traffic counts on the road. So if you want to use County Road and bike on a low-traveled road, so it gives traffic counts, and it also identifies where the trails are. And certainly folks can go to our website and look for trail information there.
Well, thank you so much for coming. I've been speaking with Lisa Hine, who's with the Natural Heritage Foundation, which is based out of Des Moines, mm-hmm. speaking about biking trails in Iowa and the bike culture that's growing up around it, on a new level mm-hmm. with the High Trestle Trail. Okay. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Ursula Rudenberg. We started out the show with Dick and Judy Lamb, who own land in Boone County and are part of a lawsuit opposing the seizure of that land by eminent domain for the building of the crude oil pipeline known as the Bakken Pipeline.
We then explore the riches to be had in this area this summer with Matt Nissen, winemaker and events coordinator at Prairie Moon Winery, and Lisa Hine of Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation about the High Trestle Trail and Bridge.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates of all our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for making that possible.
Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Thank you, Jonah. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Badger by Charlie Parr.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.